make a few announcements before we get started with the program for the morning. First announcement is, people who are getting the CEUs, you need to do two things. Three things. First, you need to sign on the usual sheet. Second, you need to take your completed form. You have to put your license number in, because I didn't know it. But I put your name and I signed it. Please take that. And then please fill out an evaluation. And it can be an anonymous evaluation. And then just fold it over and leave it there. And I will just give them to the office without looking at them. Okay? If anybody has a question about the CEU, see me right after class. It should be pretty obvious. But CEU people, it's all over there. Okay, watch you sit there. Yeah. Well, yeah, but first we're going to sit down here and then after. Okay. Thank you. Okay, a few announcements. First, this is the last class for this session of consciousness class. We resume again on April 8th for five classes. So consciousness class starts again April 8th. Dave Humes is going to teach, I think, two times at this time between now and the end of March in here. He's going to be doing a Friday and a Saturday, the duplicate classes twice. So if you want to do it at this time and you're interested in Dave's classes, he will be teaching too. The idea was to give him a little room to do that. On the 20th of February, I'm going to be teaching Adventures in Consciousness in room 31. If you're going to come to Adventures in Consciousness, first sign up. Second, it's 3 hours, 9:30 to 1:30, 9:30 to 12:30 on Saturday morning. If possible, bring stuff to lie down on. It's a carpeted room, but you might want a mat and something for your head. If not, you can sit in a chair. You might want to bring your own chair or something to make a chair more comfortable, because we're going to get incredibly deeply relaxed. And then focus our mind completely. So we can have certain super conscious experiences.
We need some chairs there for me, because my arthritis. We need some chair for me.
There'll be chairs. There'll be chairs like this.
Okay.
So that's on February 20th. On February 29th, Leap Day, Roger Yonka is going to give the Mind Supermind talk on Tai Chi and Qigong. And he's world famous about that. You really might want to come to Roger's talk. Mind Supermind's on the 29th. Let's see. After the last class in the spring, our last class, we're going to have an art fair. So be thinking, all you artists, and most of you are, about what you want to bring into the art fair, okay? That'll be the very beginning of May.
That's a really good vacation on next spring.
What am I going to teach on?
Yeah.
I don't know. I have no idea. Falls from the sky. It'll be, I don't know. Julie, you know, it'll come together. From Rabbi Gewirtz last week, somebody asked him a question and he didn't know how to respond to that person because he didn't know who that person was. So he asked me to find out who that person was and give the response, but I thought I'd just tell you all, because it's an interesting response. After class, he was asked, in Jewish understanding, when does the soul enter the body? And he entered the body of the embryo. And he said, at conception. And then he thought about it, and he corrected himself, and he said, tell the person, whoever you are, and everybody else, that in Jewish understanding, it enters at 40 days. It enters the embryo at 40 days, which is, it has a whole different set of implications.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? So that's what he said.
Okay.
Next, let us sit for 10 minutes in silence. I've taken you off the training wheels, and you get 10 minutes to sit on your own as you know how to do, okay? I'll ring the bell to begin, and then, yeah. Well, you certainly are a noisy bunch. Okay, what we're going to do now is Joseph and I are going to go up on stage here so you can kind of see us better. And then I'll introduce him, and we will dialogue a little bit, and then maybe you can question him a little bit also.
Let's see. What I'd like to do is take this up here.
Good to climb up it?
Or do we have a stairway here?
So this session that we're about to do is a session. In that, we're going to be contemplating some fairly profound things. And I think it's best to do that in a very conscious state. So those of you who want to stay mindful, I'm going to try to. So, first, Joseph Bobrow, B-O-B-R-O-W, Joseph Bobrow is a Zen master at Deep Streams Zen Institute in Santa Barbara and a retired psychoanalyst. For 4 decades, he has been integrating Buddhist practice and Western psychology to create learning and healing environments. A rural cooperative school for young children and their parents. An educational and support program for divorcing families. Mentoring and meditation groups for incarcerated teenagers. And experiential workshops on spiritual maturity and emotional growth for health practitioners. Thich Nhat Hanh said of Joseph's first book, Zen and Psychotherapy, Partners in Liberation, quote, "Please read this book with a feeling of gratitude. Joseph is a true teacher of meditation," end quote. Since 2006, Joseph has provided interdisciplinary retreats that mobilize the power of community to help veterans, their families, and their caregivers transform the traumas of war and find peace. In his foreword to Joseph's new book, Waking Up from War, His Holiness the Dalai Lama writes, quote, "I am deeply happy to learn that since 2007, Joseph Bobrow and Coming Home Project have made the inner peace of veterans and their families their priority, and have dedicated themselves to helping them. I congratulate Joseph and his team for their altruism and dedication and wish them success." Joseph lives in Santa Barbara, California, and teaches widely. It is my great privilege and pleasure to introduce Dr. Joseph Bobrow Roshi. And now that we're done with all the formal stuff, I have a few questions for Joseph. And he hasn't seen these questions before. And it took me about 20 seconds to write them. I mean, it was obvious what I wanted to ask. So, with no rehearsal, here you go, Joe. First, in your understanding, based on Zen and Buddhism more generally, do we have a soul? And is there an afterlife? And what happens to us when we die?
Well, I haven't died yet, so I don't know. But I'm very curious. And the death of my 97-year-old mother a couple of months ago has really brought me up right against that great mystery. Not being able to imagine that she's actually gone, but knowing that she is gone, and being right up against a question. So, in Zen, being curious, being open, and entertaining questions is much more important than having ideological beliefs one way or the other. The opportunity in this life is to understand our life and our death profoundly, immediately, and not necessarily in a conceptual way. So our concepts about things can help us organize our thoughts, but really when it comes down to it, it's our direct experience. What is the stuff of this life? And from a Zen perspective, there are, if we talk a little bit philosophy here, there are five bundles or skandhas. One is form or the body, the next is sensation and perception, mental formation and consciousness, called the five skandhas or the five bundles. And we ourselves are composed of an interaction of those bundles that are coming together and shifting moment to moment as a function of the causes and conditions that we find ourselves in. So from a Zen perspective and from a Buddhist perspective, there's no solid self that lasts through space and time that we can take to the bank, that we can say is our rock and our redeemer. Conditions are shifting, causes are shifting, and we are, again, a function of body, sensation, perception, mental formation, and our consciousness shifting from moment to moment. Isn't it a miracle, then, that there is Spencer, that there is Joe, that there's each of us, that we wake up in the morning, that we brush our teeth, that we hear the birds, that we laugh, that we weep. It is a great miracle. And entering that miraculousness and that mystery of who we are is the invitation of Zen. So I'm slightly dodging your question, because I personally don't feel that that's where the action is. Because, you know, we could come up with an idea about that, and we could debate that. But what does that give us? I will tell you a funny story, however, about my old Japanese teacher, Yamada Koen Roshi. Who I don't know if any of you have ever read The Three Pillars of Zen. It's one of the old Zen books. And at the end, they tell these enlightenment stories. And he's in there as the Japanese businessman, and he talks about a life-changing experience that he had. He would come every year to the Maui Zendo when I was there for 15 years and lead a session, you know, a seven-day retreat. And we became very close. He's kind of like a grandfather to me in the Dharma, in Buddhist practice. And somebody once asked him the same question. You know, are there future lives? And knowing that in Zen, that's not our emphasis. We don't know. And we proudly cultivate what we call don't know mind, or beginner's mind, proudly. So he said, well, I'm not sure, but if there was, then I would like to be a big, big oak tree with a wide trunk and showering branches. Roots went really deep and providing shelter and shade for the travelers along the way. And I just thought that was very beautiful. And then he added, by the way, and if that was so, then I would like my wife to also be a big old oak tree right next to me, providing shade and shelter for the travelers, so our roots underneath intermingle and connect. And I've rarely heard a more human, a sweeter, and more honest description of what might happen in another life.
Having said what you just said, all my rest of my questions are no, but...
Well, let's see what comes out.
Or let's see what comes up when I ask the same stupid question in different ways.
No, in Zen, we love dialogue. It's counterintuitive. Sometimes people think that Zen is very solitary, very severe, very hermit-like, but actually... the relationship between teacher and student, and also teachers and students and everybody, is very dynamic. There's a long history of question and answer, and it goes back and forth. I remember when my American teacher, my root teacher, Robert Aitken, spoke about Doksan, which is a one-to-one private meeting between teacher and student. And someone said, well, how do you think about Doksan when you meet your student? He said, when I meet my student, it's meeting my own teacher. There's that sense of learning with each other, trying to go beyond our usual thoughts about things and see if we can find something new that sparks us. So
those are, these are stupid questions. Actually, in Zen, they're nonsensical questions. All right. So we hear about this term Buddha nature. Could you say something about it? Always has intrigued me. What can you say about Buddha nature?
Masao Abe was a great Japanese philosopher and Zen teacher. And I remember him coming to the Maui Zendo one time, and people asked him about nothingness because they had a kind of fetish about Zen interest in nothingness. And so his response has stayed with me for 40 years. He said, "Nothing is not something called nothing." We just sort of take that in for a moment.
Say it again.
Nothing is not something called nothing. So in the Diamond Sutra, which is a famous Zen song or poem, a text that we chant, it says that there is nothing to be called Buddha, therefore we call it Buddha. So, Buddha nature is a concept, like many concepts, and it may help us, and it may hinder us, and tie us up in knots. But the idea is that when each of us practices being present, as you've been practicing with Spencer, and really sinking into the silence, becoming aware of our thoughts and how they kind of compel us and hook us in, and continue to become aware and release those thoughts and the attachments that go with our conceptual mind, with our ideologies. As we really sink into the present moment as deeply as we can, we sense something that's beyond verbal description. I would like somebody to raise their hand who's not at least nibbled around the margins of something like that. I think all of us have. There's some experience of depth or vastness or space that's hard to put into words. Now, we do put it into words. Some people call it God, some people call it the transcendent, some people call it Buddha nature. The operative point to Buddha nature is that as rare as our human existence is, and I'll give you a metaphor for that in a moment, we, each of us, has the capacity to wake up to a dimension of life that is not usually accessible through our thinking. We have this capacity, just like the historical Buddha. That's one of the important teachings of Zen, that all of us can, through our practice, in a chair, on a cushion, in our daily interactions with people, if we're able to really bring the quality of sustained, profound mindfulness to all of the moments of our life, we can wake up just like Buddha Shakyamuni woke up. So then our question becomes, well, what did he discover? When, after going through ascetic practices and trials and tribulations, we spend years under the Bodhi tree, the Pipala tree, and sitting in deep meditation, and one morning he awoke and he looked up and he saw the morning star. And in that moment, all of his theories fell away. All of his ideas, we have a soul, we don't have a soul, there is a future life, there's not a future life, I'm good, I'm bad, I'm a success, I'm a failure, I made it, I didn't make it, people love me, people don't love me. All of that sort of very human kinds of mulling just completely fell away. And he was awake. He was awake to that star. That's shining. We come close to it through the song, right? Twinkle, twinkle. But each of us is like that star. He's like a jewel. Just waiting to release our version of something that's way bigger than any of us personally, but it's refracted through our own particular being in the world, if you will. Each of us is a jewel that shines with a distinct light that has a unique contribution to this world. And yet, we shine with that, with a light that that goes beyond any of our individual identity. So, in Zen and Buddhism in general, our invitation is to touch that which goes beyond all of our differences and bring that forward in our daily living according to the circumstances and conditions we find ourselves in, and only through our own talent. I can't be Spencer, you can't be Joe, but we can find in our unity, in our profound interconnection, we can bring forward something completely unique and share it with the world. So that's and the path to discovering our Buddha nature is mindful practice in each moment of our life. Realizing the narrow ways we construe our life and other people, and letting them go moment to moment to moment. Cultivating, again, don't know mine. Cultivating curiosity. Entering that mystery that I felt so profoundly after my mother died. There's just, I just can't grasp it. I just can't grasp it. How could she not be here? She was just here. So it didn't take so much the form of where did she go, but it was like, what is this death of ours? It's a great mystery. And then it dawned on me, what is this life about? Made of that same stuff, that same shifting stuff. The stuff is not different. And kind of embracing the gratitude for being alive. And remembering that, I don't know if it's the Tibetans or which Buddhists say that the chances of our being born human are the same as the chances of a singular whale swimming around in the Pacific and a human having tossed out a round buoy and that one whale coming up in one breach and coming up right, catching that buoy with his snout. That's the chances of being born human. So the invitation is to say, despite our conditions, despite our sorrows, despite our pains, can we really come to appreciate fully this humanity and beyond ideology touch something very, very profound that simultaneously unites us, but that we each present in a different way? It's kind of a wordy answer.
Because it was an answer on both a intellectual level, but also it kept having the suggestion of the practice. Every other phrase is about letting go and being present, and it was constantly guided.
Well, that's because life presents us incredible opportunities to wake up. I remember this one Korean Zen teacher, Sungsan Sunsanin. If you're interested, you could read a compilation of his talks called Dropping Ashes on the Buddha, which is put together by his old student and now a very famous translator and writer, Stephen Mitchell, called Dropping Ashes on the Buddha. And he had a very loud style, unlike my Zen teachers or my other Vietnamese Zen teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, very quiet style. And he would discourse with anybody. If he was here today, he'd be challenging some of you individually and engaging you in Dharma dialogue. I remember him, someone asked him about Buddha or Buddha nature, and he said, well, let's think of it in terms of a Judeo-Christian metaphor, God. God is always calling, but our phone is busy. And he had this disarming way of putting it. The Buddha nature is calling. So when we wake up in the morning, when we're weeping, when we're laughing, when we're doing the dishes, all of those are gateways to our Buddha nature if we can completely forget ourselves as we immerse in those activities, whatever they are. If we could completely engage in any one activity, we find the whole universe, just like that.
So that may have just answered my next question, but it's an interesting segue. I once had Doksan with Sansanim.
Oh!
And,
small world.
Yeah. And he asked me some koan, and I looked at him, and I... smart though I thought I was, I went, I don't know. And he went, he lit up, and he went, you know what he can say, he went, very good. Only keep, don't know mine, you be enlightened. And I always have remembered that teaching. But it brings up the question of, what does he mean by enlightened? So we hear this word enlightenment a lot. Can you tell us any enlightenment stories or give us any illumination on that subject?
So first I'm going to respond very simply and very purely, and then maybe I'll say some words. Thank you. Now maybe I'll say some words.
Did you get the lesson?
There are so many stories about Zen teachers presenting awakening just like that. Just like that. Sometimes in a somewhat more playful way, where the teacher will stand up, turn around, and sit back down. Or my teacher, Robert Aitken, was very down to earth. And so he would just take out his toothbrush. Within our daily experience are not only the seeds, but the direct experience of awakening. Within our daily experience. Jim Forrest was a peace activist protesting the Trident submarine in Seattle many, many years ago. He worked with the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And he was friends with Thich Nhat Hanh, who was one of my old teachers. And he protested, was arrested, and was treated harshly and put in solitary confinement. And he wrote Thich Nhat Hanh confessing to some measure of despair. And Thich Nhat Hanh wrote back a letter, this is in the 60s, which has since become famous, so you may have heard of the tangerine meditation. At Buddhist retreats now, sometimes we do eating meditation, really paying attention to peeling the tangerine. But this, to my knowledge, originated with Thich Nhat Hanh, who wrote Jim back and said, even in your prison, you can be free. Now, politically, he's not free. Physically, he's not free. But you can be fundamentally free. So he said, what did they serve you to eat? So he wrote back saying, well, I get a tangerine. He said, here's how you practice freedom. And he described mindfully holding that tangerine with the appreciation for how it came to him, all that went into this tangerine. And then mindfully peeling and smelling the aroma that emits as you start to peel it. And likewise, each particular step, just fully appreciating, fully being alive, letting that tangerine wake you up, be your teacher. And as Jim began to practice the tangerine meditation, his despair and his claustrophobia, I mean, you can just imagine being in solitary confinement, not being able to see anybody. It began to lift, it began to ease. And he began to feel alive again. And he began to feel as if his cell was even spacious. And he wasn't pretending that he was not in jail. It wasn't a hallucination. But he found some measure of awakening right like that. So, for many of us, our worlds are physically free. We can speak our mind, we have certain freedoms, we can go where we want. Hopefully we don't want too much for material things. But our inner life, our minds, tend to feel imprisoned, tend to feel like something is holding us back, or that we're not fully alive, that we're not fully free. And so, there is, of course, I'm focusing on one element, which is this element of moment-to-moment awareness, plunging in, embracing our lives, whatever they are, their illness, all the limitations that we face, especially as we get older, and holding them just like we hold the joys in our life with deep appreciation and curiosity. Now, you asked about enlightenment, and certainly Zen is known for, it even has a couple of words, Satori, Kensho, and there's a lot of folklore about that experience of awakening or enlightenment in the Zen tradition. I've come to think that too much is made of it, actually, because even if through diligent, concentrated practice one does have an experience of awakening, in the next moment it can dissipate. And we can be our same small, narrow, petty, self-absorbed, nasty self in the next moment. So that's why I put more of a premium on this moment-to-moment awareness of the inside, of the outside, being able to track the impact that we have on other people, on people, places, and things. Trying to track, is it benevolent impact? Is it not? Just really trying through one's own presence, through one's own activities, create as much benevolence as possible and do as little harm as possible. But let me say a little bit just the same about an experience of awakening. I have a colleague who teaches Zen, and he was at a retreat, and he was very immersed in his sitting to the point of really forgetting himself and forgetting, not trying to figure things out anymore, completely immersed. And when the bell rang, he got up and he needed to go to the bathroom, and he left and went to the bathroom. And then in that frame of mind, he sneezed. And he took out his handkerchief. And in that sneeze, it was just like the Buddha looking up at the morning star. All of the ideas, including perhaps especially ideas of enlightenment and delusion and saint and sinner, enlightened one, deluded one, everything fell away. And it was just that sneeze. And it just filled the whole screen. And in that moment, he felt incredibly connected with everybody who was at the session, as if they were one and the same. He felt an incredible sense of connection with the birds and the trees and his family and everything. He felt as if literally, they were all one body. And each of them had the Buddha nature, this indescribable nature that we call Buddha, that cannot be really conveyed by discursive thought. He was very, 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 very deeply happy. And he also recognized that everybody had this capacity. And in fact, not only did they have the capacity, but they themselves were already awakened. If only they could realize that just as they were, without any self-improvement, without any self-flagellation, they already were manifesting their Buddha nature. So he had access to these kinds of realizations in that moment. So there's another example of someone who wasn't practicing Zen. And it's very sweet and a little sad to tell you the story, because it's my first trip to Santa Barbara was to visit her after my father had died in 1977. I did a retreat in L.A., and she was one of the founders of the L.A. Zen Center, and she was also a psychologist, one of the pioneers in biofeedback way back when. And her name was Flora Courtois. I don't know if any of you have known Flora Courtois. But she was a very dear friend, lived up on APS, and I came to visit her. And we would talk just about all these fascinating things. And she's a real Zen lady. And then we would just sit quietly and watch the sun set at dusk and just enjoy one another. Well, Flora, when she was a college student, before she had ever practiced Zen, she had an experience of enlightenment. And I'm telling you this only to take it out of the realm of what might seem to you like a cult. You know, like it's a Zen experience, or but it's not. It's a perennial experience. Aldous Huxley used to call awakening a perennial experience. Part of our human capacity, resource base. She happened to have one, an experience where she was just sitting quietly, completely absorbed, thinking a little bit about her studies, mulling over some point in philosophy. But then she became more absent-minded, she called it. Maybe she was not knowing right in that moment. But she may have become like absent-minded. And then she looked at her green desk. And that green desk just became the whole universe. And everything fell away, and time and space completely changed. And she had this sense that life was one big symphony, with each moment being a note in that symphony. And this was as real as could be, but it made her feel kind of crazy because she went and talked with her philosophy professors and they thought she had a screw loose, so she was kind of losing it. And she began to retreat and feel isolated until she learned that there was a Zen teacher coming to town, Yasutani Roshi, and she made it a point to tell him about this experience. And he confirmed that, well, you know, according to Zen criteria, this was a genuine experience of enlightenment. And she wrote it up in a very beautiful little book, very unassuming book called My Experience of Enlightenment, Flora Courtois. So all of us are capable, to one degree or another, capable of waking up to this sense of vast belonging. I was listening to Brother David Sendelhoff. I don't know if you know him. He was a wonderful teacher. I remember taking my teacher, Robert Aitken, to have a dialogue with him, much like this, at a radio station in the Bay Area, which turned out to be the subject matter for a book that they did together called The Ground We Share. If you're interested, very interesting book on the one of the first books about the relationship between Christianity and Christian mysticism and Zen. In any case, I just happened to be listening to Brother David, and he's just so sweet. You just listen to his voice, and you just kind of melt. That's kind of his presentation, is his voice. You almost don't care what he could say, anything. But actually, what he was saying was also very interesting. And he was asked about God, and he didn't go into it at all from a theological perspective, like zero. He said, I'm thinking of it now in terms of limitless belonging. And I was doing my yoga and listening to this. I just, you know, words may not be able to fully convey something, but they can convey a lot when we find a good metaphor. A poet can convey something of what can't be described. Limitless belonging. Just so wonderful. I especially liked it because sometimes limitless and vastness, measurelessness, which are words that describe our Buddha nature or our true nature, beyond ideology, it leaves you a little bit cold. It leaves you a little bit sort of spinning in space. But limitless belonging, isn't that what we want? I mean, we want to feel that we're a part of things. If it's our relationship or our family or the family of humankind or our earth or our solar system or our universe or beyond any of those concepts, to be part of the greater scheme of things. Limitless belonging. So, there you have it. You have a show and tell.
Which way to go? I think okay. does...
Always go with the feeling.
Feeling is the one who do this for many years. But the two things that are in my, that I'm watching in my mind are some more stuff about Zen and Buddhist practice, which I'm going to ask about. But then I want to go toward the differences between psychotherapy and Buddhist understanding.
Okay.
So we're going to go in first a little more Zen direction, and then we're going to go into the what are the assumptions that undergird Western psychology.
Okay.
And okay, so the next question has to do with evil.
Mm.
What, it's a hard one for us. What do you understand based on your knowledge and practice? How come there's such bad stuff that happens if our basic nature is limitless belonging?
Well, there are two parts to that question. The first thing I'll say is that evil is very real. When you're in the presence of it, you know it. We have had way, way too much of it in our modern times and in our recent past and from time immemorial. I won't say that cell phones are evil. They're sometimes annoying, but they're not evil. I don't think it's good to categorize people as permanently and forever evil, because we are all so incredibly complex. But there's no doubt that when the five skandhas, or the five bundles, as I call them before, body, sensation, perception, our mental formations, and our consciousness, come together, and there are certain causes and conditions that are helping instantiate a particular person, say, called Joe, that in my response toward those causes and conditions, my response can be malevolent, my response can be maladaptive, my response can make things worse. The way that I coalesce as me, the way that I respond to certain traumatic situations, can be for better or for worse. And I think there are people, there are forces at play that come together. I mean, you think of the Holocaust, you think of the movement that Adolf Hitler created. You think of some of the brutality of ISIS. There are many different levels at which harm is being created in small to massive degrees. And there's the other dimension in which each of us, despite our best intentions, can do harm when that's the last thing that we would want to do. And how important it is in our interpersonal relationships, again, to always be open to the feedback of the other. Because I may feel like my stuff doesn't smell. I'm just squeaky clean, and I'm leaving a wonderful, peaceful wake behind me as I leave. But actually, I can be leaving roadkill as I drive away and not even know it. So, there are traumas, big and little, that, you know, the best intent, the road to hell is lined with good intentions. In Buddhism, we take it a step deeper, and here's where it actually does link up with Western psychology. In Buddhism, we say it's not just our actions themselves, but our intentions behind the actions that will determine whether they are benevolent, malevolent, or just perpetuate the status quo. But the challenge from that Buddhist perspective is, again, we, all of us, I think, for the most part, unless we're just completely caught up in anger or hatred or spite or something, and we knowingly are doing bad stuff. But that tends to be rare, I think, amongst most of us. We actually think that we're doing good stuff. And there is a concept and a register of experience and a mode of inquiry within psychoanalysis, and the concept is unconscious motivation. What are we really getting at? What's our really deepest intention? How are we communicating that with the energy we bring to each situation? I call it a psychic fuel. So I think that I can be Johnny Appleseed spreading joy, but actually I may have a current of contempt or arrogance that's running through me that only you might be able to pick up. And so then, if I'm enlightened, do I have the wherewithal to stop and say, you don't seem to have picked up what I intended to convey. Please, inform me. I'm in Dokusan with you. Be my teacher. And then, can I be enlightened by the other? So if I'm open to doing that, to that sort of intrinsic self-correction, you could call it a relational mindful practice, right? So, because I have limits to my own mindfulness. And this is something that even the Dalai Lama, it's not within his frame of reference. I was at a conference where he was, and they stuck me in the front row, and I got to ring the bell for people who were speaking, when they were getting close to the end of their time. So I'm like 10 paces from him. I wasn't ringing him out, but ringing out people who would come up and ask questions. And somebody asked a question, I think it was actually a famous teacher, asked a question, you know, Your Holiness, we have in Buddhism, this was a time where some Buddhist teachers were being exposed as having done harmful things with their students, either broken vows or boundaries, sexual boundaries, or money or power exploitation. And he said, in Buddhism, we're having such a hard time. We have such many things to deal with. So His Holiness is taking all of that in, and the teacher says, "Well, do you have any last words for us?" And I think the Dalai Lama picked up that there was some anxiety and concern, and took it all in, and rocked back and forth, and then he said, like a good psychoanalyst, not only like a good Buddhist teacher, he said, when I'm uncertain or confused, I check my motivation. And if my motivation is afflicted, I work on myself. But if my motivation is benevolent, then I'm not shaken by what anybody says about me. And it was such a gift to this person. I could see it release his anxieties. It's like, where are you coming from? That would be a colloquial way of talking about it. Where are you really coming from? Because we oftentimes don't know what we're, quote-unquote, putting out there. We can think that it's good, but what is it really? So this idea of unconscious motivation. Now, with the Dalai Lama, he's been, being mindful and examining his motivation for many decades, and who knows how much longer, and he does it in a very profound way. But I raised my hand and asked, are there limits to how much we can know and check our motivations, become mindful? And I think there are. And I think in the relational setting, of psychotherapy as a kind of petri dish or laboratory for all of our human interactions, we can really learn how we affect one another emotionally. Because we do. We are affecting one another emotionally, moment to moment. We're discovering it now through the neurological research, that the right part of our brain communicates with the right part of the other's brain automatically beneath the threshold of consciousness. It's just the way it happens. And we're already having certain experiences with one another before we open our mouths. And so, for me, that makes it all the more important that we be as mindful as we can, not only of our own thoughts and feelings and sensations, and cultivate those that we learn through our experience are benevolent and life-giving, both for us and for others. But it makes me realize that it behooves each of us to practice a kind of relational mindfulness in which we're also open to being taught by the other. For example, I can have, a corporation like, what was the name of the first ecologist who wrote The Silent Spring? Rachel Carson. So back in the day, there were these corporations and they were letting out all their effluents in the rivers, and the rivers were turning colors and people were getting sick. But they thought they were doing really good. They didn't know where to look for the impacts of their actions. We are so interconnected as human beings with one another, with the plant world, with the animal world. And we're interconnected within ourselves, our thoughts, our feelings, our sensations, our actions. That we need to be open to feedback. And that's what I think the ecology movement is saying. Now, can we see the feedback that Mother Nature is giving us right now? Can we see that the glaciers are melting? Can we see that certain island states are being flooded? Can we see the impacts of our behavior? So I have taken a view, a kind of integral view of enlightenment, so to speak, that it's not just about my awakening and my joy and my well-being, my profound well-being, at the discovery of the preciousness of my life and the fact that what we call the transcendent, what we call the measureless, is manifest each time I sneeze, each time I tie my shoe, that I'm in the midst of the holy, every single moment. That leads to a kind of besottedness, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, what a pleasure. What does Rumi call it? Drinking the wine? Or, there are all these metaphors for this kind of profound joy that comes with realizing that I don't have to prove myself. I don't have to succeed. That just as I am, I'm a lamp. And, but does it stop there? You see, does it stop there at our own awakening, at our own pleasure? Or do we ask, how can I be of service? How am I already being either of service or not to the world in my very conduct? And how can I develop that? This leads us to the idea of a bodhisattva. Have you heard of what a bodhisattva?
Yes.
So in Zen, Tibetan Buddhism, other forms of Mahayana Buddhism, this is kind of the archetype of the awakened person. It's not so much that we awaken solely for ourselves, but that we find that when we awaken to the sacredness within, around, infusing us, then we find that other people are benefiting from that, and that we can share that with others to improve their life, to help them realize their potential for peace and connectedness. And we don't have to be afraid that this person or that person is going to achieve more than us, because it's not a zero-sum game. That's the other thing that's thrown out in the experiment of enlightenment.
Can I make a suggestion right now?
Sure.
I think to hold that idea,
okay.
my sense is that if you stood up and stretched for a minute, because my butt's hurting, and then you sat in silence for about 2 minutes, that it would allow more opening again, because it's been so profound. You know what I mean? So if let's stand up and stretch for a couple minutes.
Some digestion?
Yeah, exactly. This is really important stuff. Stretch. And then then if we sit in silence for about 2 or 3 minutes, to just let everything kind of percolate and clear out and open up again. Okay? So I'm going to ring the bell, and in about 3 minutes I'll ring the bell again. So in these 3 minutes, what I suggest is that you just open up and let everything clear out so you can be receptive again. So we were in the middle of, I interrupted you in the middle of a statement. Did you want to complete that statement?
Well, a bodhisattva is someone who realizes that as they blossom and embrace their true nature, in the particulars of their lives, other people benefit. And when other people blossom and flourish, there's nothing to be afraid of. They're not taking anything from me. I take pleasure and joy in the blossoming, flourishing, freedom, the liberation of others. Why is that? Because the bodhisattva understands how profoundly interconnected we all are. And that what benefits you most deeply and truly benefits me. And likewise, back at you.
So I have one more question that I'm going to ask Joseph, and then I will throw the floor open for your question. Not literally. Metaphorically, I will throw the floor open for your question. So my last question, which is another trivial little question, is what's the relationship, you wrote a book on this, you're a retired psychoanalyst, what's the relationship between psychotherapy and Buddhist practice? I mean, do you need both? When do you do what?
Well, I think a profound intersection of the two is something I just described. So I was just talking about a kind of integrated view of awakening in terms of our ability to track and cultivate benevolent activity and be able to track the impacts of our actions. And the approach that Buddhism takes to that, which is it's not what you do, but it's the intention behind it, and how psychoanalytic view of unconscious motivation adds to the mix and allows us, first of all, to understand that the road to hell can be lined with good intentions and that we've got to really go deeper to examine our impact on others and stay open to the other. So that's one very important intersection, because if the Buddhist path is that do no harm, benefit others, and awaken yourself, then this concept from psychoanalysis helps the Buddhist project realize itself. And I'll say more, but what the Buddhist project brings to psychotherapy or depth psychology is a real appreciation for how do we pay attention? How do we really pay attention? When Freud had his idea of free association, that you come in and you talk to your analyst and you say as much as you can the things that you're really thinking, things that are really up for it. Speak your mind just as it is. At that point in time, he didn't include share your imagery, your physical sensations, your colors that you might... He was talking at that point about words. And Buddhism has a long history of expanding and refining what it means to really be attentive, what it means to pay attention to the present moment, to really enter the present moment, become intimate. I like that word, intimate, with our moment-to-moment experience. And that includes, as is right on the board there, and I'm assuming, Spence, that you wrote it on the board, body, breath, sensation, emotion, perception, beliefs as they're coming together, mental formations, concepts and ideologies, and then consciousness itself. Can we pay attention to that scope and how they all interact with one another to form certain states of mind, certain states of being? That then we sometimes get trapped in, and we can't find our way out of, or we don't even know that we're in, and we think we're doing something else. So Buddhism helps us liberate ourselves through a very close attentiveness that's not like the military. No, it's not like that. It's a very supple, very loving, very kind, yet focused awareness. And so I'm not surprised that there are droves and droves, not only of psychoanalysts, but of psychotherapists of all stripes, who have begun practicing mindfulness and who have maybe taken it the next step and done some retreats, and maybe even found a teacher to work with on a regular basis. They find that it very much enriches both their work as therapists and the work as, you know, their own experience as human beings, what they bring to the table. So attention is one area where these two fields intersect. Buddhism is one of the most intersubjective praxis, intersubjective set of principles and actions of any school of thought or any religion. It is intersubjective from the get-go. When I say that each of us, I remember Krishnamurti saying, "You are the universe." He had a book called "You Are the Universe." Now, if I don't have that experience for myself, then usually you call me a megalomaniac, and you should. But the Blake said that you find eternity in a grain, infinity in a grain of sand, and eternity in an hour. This is the paradoxical sense of the whole and the part. Remind me of the question, because
so the question is the intersection.
Got it. Buddhism posits that the all is in the one, and the one is the all, and it's up to us to experience that, and then to share that experience in a very unself-conscious way, not in a preachy, proselytizing way, but very direct ways. How could we share? We see somebody cut themselves on the street, they fell and cut themselves. How do we share that jewel? How do we respond in that moment? Because God isn't farther than that moment. How do we respond right there? So, but we're also connected through the emotions. Not just existentially, part and parcel of one another, but we're connected through the emotional world. And afflictive emotions, particularly in the classical Theravadan Buddhist perspective and the Tibetan perspective, in Zen we don't explore it that much, but I certainly have, because I have my share of afflictive emotions. I've become very keen to understand them and not let them dominate or hijack my well-being. Especially as my life gets shorter, I don't want anything to hijack my well-being and my ability to interact in a fruitful way with the world. So we have emotions that we're unaware of. That's a psychoanalytic understanding. This whole idea that we have experience that we're unaware of, or we're unconscious of, or that we're not aware of, not necessarily formally unconscious. That's a very important contribution to the practice of liberation, is to understand that despite our best efforts, there are things inside of us that we're not aware of. And it's also important to understand that there are impacts that we have, emotional connections with others, that we may think, again, as I said before, are benevolent interaction, but they may actually be afflictive. They may be hindering somebody else. And when we are not open to the possibility that this is the case, then we can easily get caught up in afflictive emotions and take them for sweet-smelling benevolence. And then we can become psychopaths, sociopaths, megalomaniacs. We can say and forgive, this is not a political talk, but we can say, we're going to be greeted as liberators. It's going to be a slam dunk. I mean, it's just, why? Because I know that I mean well. But why don't millions of other people feel that I mean well? Am I open to the feedback that my well-meaning intentions have over time to look at, in the case of war, the grave damage that lasts generations and generations that I've come to know so intimately in working with thousands of returning veterans and their families and their kids. I've come to know on the ground floor the impacts of war. So, I like to think of enlightenment on two tracks, or liberation on two tracks. And I'll summarize, and then we'll move on. But this idea, in a way, is heretical, because, particularly from the Buddhist perspective, you can't have two tracks, you know. But I think there is something called emotional growth that lasts a lifetime, that we're always refining our character. We're always learning more about ourselves, becoming more aware, going deeper, and having segments of our personality, of our history, we're reviewing traumas that we've gone through from different perspectives. This continues a lifetime. One enlightenment experience, despite what commonplace wisdom sometimes says, doesn't eliminate that. It just opens you to a reality you can then cultivate and make more and more part of your life. But it doesn't wipe away everything that you've lived. So it's up to us to continue to grow emotionally, to use the interpersonal experiences we have, the people, places, and things we encounter, our own limitations as we go, to use them skillfully to try to see the opportunity for deepening, for growth, even in the most challenging circumstances. And there you have a kind of emotional ripening, seasoning. And you kind of know it when you're around somebody. And they smile and they look you in the eyes and you look at their eyes and go, whoa, this person has seen the world, but they're right here with me and I feel like I'm the only person in the world for them right now. We know people like this. They're treasures in our lives. And you wouldn't know what they've been through because they're just right there with you. With a loving receptiveness to you. So this is kind of what we can cultivate in terms of emotional ripening. On the other hand, I say it's on the other hand, but these two things are not really two. We're just talking about them for purposes of your question. There's this other side of it, which is this profound existential thirst or curiosity. I know I had it when I was young for a lot of personal reasons, and also just because I was kind of wired that way. Wondering, who am I? Who am I really? I mean, I see who's in the mirror, you know, but who's this guy in this bag of skin? Kind of. Sometimes I look in the mirror, I still don't know. I say, well, who is that guy? I mean, I'm going around and I'm interacting with people. I don't know, and that brings up this curiosity, this question: who am I? Where did I come from? Where am I going? Remember when I first entered my Zen teacher's room in Hawaii to do an interview with him. He had a Gauguin print, which I now have on my wall, and it was a print from Tahiti. You probably have seen it, showing all the walks of life, an old people, the old person, a baby, a family, a wise man, a dead corpse. Everything is in this painting. And in the corner of it, he points out to me, as I'm walking in, he says, do you see what Gauguin wrote in French? He wrote, what are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? This is his first teaching. So, curiosity is a psychological phenomenon, but it's also a spiritual phenomenon. We want to know, what is this Buddha nature? What is this no thing? You know, the best thing in life are not things. We come to know that, right? Well, if the best things in life are not things, then what is this no thing? What is this mystery that I face when I try to figure out unsuccessfully how the heck my mom can not be there when she's just part of me? How is this possible? No, where am I going with this? I have to sort of help me orient again. The question was
about
right. So this is liberation on two tracks.
So this is going to be your summary.
So this is the spiritual side of liberation on two tracks. It's developing the capacity to entertain the mystery, to entertain the question, to practice mindfulness, self-regulation, relaxation, but then, from the Zen perspective, also to be open to this invitation to cultivate the question, the who am I question. What is this question? The don't know mind. And to learn to embrace that question, go deeply into that question, and see where that takes you. The courage to hold that question opens up what I call the spiritual sphere. Now, it's only if we grow and evolve as people emotionally that we can then, if we have some spiritual insights, manifest them in a healthy way with other people. We can only manifest them as much as we've matured emotionally. So I'll stop.
I guess two things. First, if you have questions for Joseph, come up right at when we end right now and ask, but you'll ask individually. Secondly, I just want to thank you for your presence today and in class in general. And I think that Joseph gave us your charge for the next month and a half is to two things, I guess. One is to inquire emotionally into yourself. What am I doing? What is its effect? And so to grow emotionally by being honest and by being good-hearted. And to ask yourself every once in a while, what is this? To entertain the question. You know? And the question is the question of this moment and what the richness of this moment is. So with those two charges, I would like to dismiss the class for this term and to appreciate Joseph. Could we appreciate Joseph?